We've left off with Matthew 24, verses 37 through 39. You may remember, as we've discussed in previous classes, Matthew 24, verses 1 through 35. Jesus, we've maintained, dealt with the destruction of Jerusalem. Then in Matthew 24, 35, you begin to see that he switches gears just a little bit. In that 35th verse, he says, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away." Then in 36, we begin to see another big shift. Jesus, in the preceding verses, talked about days, plural. Now he shifts to day. In the preceding verses, especially about verses 6 through 30, 31, he talks about various signs, and now beginning with 36, the signs simply disappear. We got down to 37 last week, so let's pick up with Matthew 24, 37 to 39. "And as it were in the days of Noah, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And they knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall be the coming of the Son of Man." As you compare this to the preceding information, you can see that there is a lot of differences. As we said, you've got the singular that's introduced here, and unlike the preceding verses where Jesus talked about the wars, the rumors of wars, the famines, the needing to not go up to the housetop and the need to flee and so forth, the rumors of military action, the persecution, all that is not here. Jesus, as he talks about his second and final coming, his next coming at the end of time, what's the comparison here? He says it's going to be like the day, it's going to be like the time of Noah. What do we know about Noah? Peter says, 2 Peter 2, verse 5, Noah was a righteous man. His occupation, he did a couple of things. Out there, maybe with a hammer and saw or something that allowed him to construct the ark. And what else did he do? He was a preacher of righteousness. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Now, I do not know how many people heard him. Maybe most of the folks heard him. We would like to think that. But we do know that the way that people responded was what? Positive or negative?
Negative.
They didn't believe him. Because you only have 8 people on the ark. And as you look at the first part of verse 38 here, in Matthew 24, he says, "For as in those days that were before the flood," this was during the time that Noah was that righteous preacher, what were they doing? All right, they were eating and drinking, and here's a place where the verb tense is significant. What do you think the tense is? They were eating and drinking. Ongoing action, present tense. So this was the regular part of life. Were they doing anything else? All right, they were getting married. We might also say that they were getting engaged. People were making plans to one day get married. If you think the world's going to end, are you planning a wedding? No? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. So in the minds of these people, life was just going to always be as it was. Now, we're not told anymore as far as what people were thinking or doing religiously, but I think there are a couple of hints. As you think about the description here, Matthew 24, 38, they're eating, they're drinking, they're thinking about marriage, they're getting married and so forth. Would you say that it looks like there's a great emphasis on self, people being self-absorbed? I mean, this is my life. You know, we've got only so many days and this is going to be how we're going to live. When you find people who are self-absorbed, what do you generally also find when it comes to religion? I'm not talking about, you know, just the true religion. I'm thinking about religion in general. Oh, okay. Anything else that we could add to that?
It's not important.
Yeah, I mean, this is my life. I'm thinking about my home, my marriage, what I'm going to have to eat, what I'm going to have to drink, the next party that we're going to see, and so forth. Well, that lines up with Genesis 6, 5 very well. Remember what he says there? And the hearts, the thoughts of men were evil. How often? Continually. Now, it's one thing to be in a society where people, they're not really religious. And maybe we have a little bit of a hyperbole in Genesis 6, 5, but think about a time. Think about a period where, as you look at the world, except for these 8 people, their hearts, their minds are devoted to evil things on a regular basis. Now that's a pretty godless culture. Well, I lay all this out for this point. Jesus says when he returns, the world's going to be what? Like the time of Noah. Well, there are at least 2 things, if I infer correctly from this passage, that will be going on when the Lord returns. Number one, what will the attitude of people be? They're going to be self-absorbed. They're going to be focused on themselves. And what about the state as far as morality? I think it's going to be evil if the comparison is correct. And then we could likely make a third point. What are we going to find when it comes to religion? All right, very few people would appear, if the comparison is correct, and we would maintain that it is, very few people are going to be focused on religion. Now, there happens to be, and if I lived another 100 years, it would never line up this well. But there happens to be, I think, a parallel to what we have in Matthew 24 with some information that we're studying on Sunday morning. If you're in the Sunday morning class, you know that we're now in the book of Revelation, the 17th chapter, and I want to flip over there for just a second. If you're not in the Revelation class, let's kind of do a quick review to get you on board. In Revelation 13, this is the place. Anybody remember what was associated with Revelation 13? Why that's an easy chapter to remember? What do we have in Revelation 6 or 13? 666, the mark of the beast, remember? People think that the number 13 is bad, and over here we read about some bad things. All right, John, in Revelation 13, he talks about two beasts, remember? First beast is about Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10. And then that second beast is introduced, I think, in Revelation 13, 11, and goes through the end of the chapter. Anybody recall what the first beast represents? Evil civil authority. And then we have the second beast, which represents, all right, false religion. We've made the point a couple of times in that class that here you have Satan, and he's got his two allies. He's got false religion, and he's got evil civil government. We made the point not too long ago that as you look at these three powers, Satan, false religion, and evil government, they have a counterpart when it comes to God and righteousness, don't they? Let's think about how we worked through that before. You have false religion. Who would be the counterpart to that in the Godhead? Well, we've got two answers. I'm going to start with the one on my right. The Holy Spirit. Why? What's false religion?
Error of the Word.
All right, error of the Word. When we think about the Holy Spirit, what's he been involved with? Jesus said the Holy Spirit's going to come. He's going to guide you into all truth. So the Holy Spirit is offering the truth. False religion, that arm of Satan, is involved in the opposite. All right? When we think about Jesus, he's the ruler over, all right, all the kings, all the earth. All right? Well, what would that line up to? We've got evil civil government. And then we have God the Father. What's the picture of him in the Bible? He's kind of the head of everything, right? He's the director. What would he be equal to? All right, he's equal to the devil. So three evil forces, three positive forces. Now, bearing that in mind, let's take a look at what we find in Revelation 17, 16. He says, "And the ten horns which thou sawest, and the beast." Well, when you think about horns, ten, we have there a number for completeness, and you think about the ten horns. What kind of power do you think we're dealing with here? It's not the devil. You think it's evil civil government, or do you think it is false religion? Anybody remember from the class? All right, very good. It's evil civil government. These kings and so forth, and we'll see a little bit more about them in Revelation 18. All right, it says, "The ten horns which thou sawest, and the beast, and these shall hate" who? The harlot. Now, we've been talking about the harlot from earlier in the chapter. John introduces her. It's also symbolized by Babylon, but the false religion. And notice this point. Let's just kind of use a paraphrase. Evil civil government that you saw. Evil civil government shall hate religion. And in this case, I think false religion is specifically in the context, but ultimately it applies all religion. And shall make her, that is, false religion, desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and shall burn her utterly with fire. Now, when you look at the descriptions, eat her flesh, make her naked, burn her with fire, does that sound like you're supporting her or opposing her? It sounds like you're, you know, diametrically opposed to her. And that seems to be the point of what we have here in Revelation 17, 16. That there, as far as I can tell, at least this is going to be the way that I explore the chapter, it looks to me like a time, and we've already seen this. I talked about this with Brian not too long ago as well. But if you think about the Dark Ages, wasn't there a time where civil government was evil and essentially tried to stamp out religion? It's happened. So what John says here is not something that's new, but this also seems to point to the state of the world at the time that the Lord is going to come. And then as you look at Revelation 18, in the next chapter, he cries with a mighty voice saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great," that is false religion. It's become a habitation of demons and a hold of every unclean spirit, and a hold or a place of every unclean and hateful bird. And then just a few verses later, in 8 through 10, he says this. Remember who is pictured as destroying false religion? Who's a destroyer? Evil civil government. Now look at 8 to 10. Therefore, in one day shall her plagues come, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judged her. And then notice this in verse 9. And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and live wantonly with her. We've talked about at times the partnership between religion and evil civil government. And there are plenty of history, lessons as far as examples of that. They were together. But when religion is destroyed, he says, evil civil government shall weep and wail over her when they look upon the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city Babylon, for the strong city in one hour is thy judgment come. Now this makes a lot of sense if you take just a second to consider it. What happens if you are able to, by and large, destroy religion? And not just in one country, not just in a communist country, but for the most part you can just wipe out religion. And I mean, I'm thinking things that would be referred to as Christian religion, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism. You can just take your religion and say it's basically gone. We've got a completely secular world. Yeah, what standard are you going to use? If you don't have a deity, whether that's a rock or whether that's a true God of heaven, where do you go as far as right and wrong? It's just the law of the land. If the law decides that the power of might is right, if you can kill somebody and get away with it, well then, that's okay. So that's going to be one of the biggest things. And can you imagine a government or a world which has basically abandoned religion as far as an authority? What's going to happen when it's time to pay taxes? Unless people, have great fear of the government, they're going to do what they want. What happens when it comes to obeying traffic laws? What happens when it comes to situations where people have some kind of verbal altercation? Now, if that interpretation is even halfway right, wouldn't that line up well with what we find in Genesis 6:5? The hearts of men were evil continually. There's nothing there to hold them back. And if you have that kind of environment, chances are God's righteous remnant is going to be few. Now, we do know that at least some will be faithful when the Lord returns. Paul tells us, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 17. Remember that statement? He says, then we that are alive shall what? Be caught up. Now, it doesn't tell us how many people are going to be alive at the end of time, but that inspired statement does suggest that there will be some people who are in a right relationship with God. So Matthew 24, 37 to 39, as we look at these verses, as we think about the end of time, if John's parallel in Revelation 17 and 18, if we've looked at that correctly, it tells us that at the end of time, this is going to be a very, very sad world. I mean, we can look at society now and say it's bad, and certainly it's not good for a lot of reasons. But Jesus' comparison suggests, at least to me, that things are going to be worse, significantly worse, when it's time for him to return. Anything that you want to add or ask, Brian? Yeah, I know. And I have to say, you have to be careful about that, because we do know that there will be some righteous people. How many righteous folks are going to be out there? Is it one? Is it 10? Is it 1,000? Is it 1,000,000? We don't know. But as far as that state, that does seem to be. So there has to be that balance there. But you're right. Right. And he says there are no signs. So you can't go that far. And I don't want to be understood to be heading out there and trying to, let's predict the general time, or get to somewhere close to that. But the general state of mankind seems to be that, without going to that length. Pat?
Isn't it maybe more like in what you put forth, that Jesus is showing us that what denotes God's time of judgment in such a universal, complete way is what matches?
And I think you can relate
more,
to that.
More than the specificity of what's happening in Genesis 6, and more than the specificity of what's happening in Revelation 17, it's the generality of what's happening in both. This is the time when God, and the thing about it, if the state gets to what it wasn't, as the state got to what it wasn't, Genesis, what happened?
Yeah.
And what if now the state gets to what it is revealed to be in Revelation 17?
Sure.
What will happen? I think that's what Jesus is conveying, not that us be able to know exactly.
Right, yeah, we know that that's wrong.
He's just conveying the actions of God and what when God acts.
we are in the time of year when we're harvesting some crops. Suppose somebody goes out to the strawberry patch or the raspberry patch and they pick it clean. What do you do? Time to leave the patch, isn't it? I mean, everything has been picked. All right, remember that principle from 2 Peter 3? God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So if you think about this in this term, you know, God is always trying to, you know, find the folks that are willing to become his people, harvest them. But when the patch is completely bare, it's time to pull the plug. Now, when's that going to occur? Can we know? I mean, the world's a big place, and even with the internet and all the technology, you know, we're never going to know when that last soul is harvested. But sometime when the world is in that state, if you think about God's desire, he doesn't want a single person to perish. But when that last person has been plucked, if you will, it seems to me, based on 2 Peter 3, what we have here, and the case of Noah. I mean, God had literally harvested all the people that could be harvested from the earth. And then at that time, he wrapped it up.
As you also alluded to, is that the similarities of what's there have been occurring continually.
Yes.
In other words, we, you know, if you would ask somebody, and if you could look at anybody who's written, at whatever time in history, they all painted this is the time,
yes,
this is the time that's coming.
Well, and if you, I don't know if we go down here quite far enough tonight, but was it 42?
Yeah.
44, actually. Notice this. And it's expressed with the present tense. Therefore be ye also ready, for in an hour that ye think not. In other words, it appears that some people are thinking that, hey, this is the time. And Jesus says, if you have those kinds of thoughts, as some people do today, expect that you're going to be wrong. And we've seen that, plenty of examples of that. So again, we're not trying to predict the date. We're not trying to pick the you know, say it's going to be during this particular period. But as far as the state of the world, and you know, things are in a pretty bad state now. I mean, the Lord could say, okay, you know, we've harvested everybody, and it's going to be wrapped up. You know, now or in the future, it could come 10,000, 100,000 years later. But the comparison to Noah is very instructive. Brian?
It seems what it says that day and hour no one knows, I mean, my father, talking about the timing of it, as the days of Noah were, so will the Son of Man be, and every verse that seems to follow it is still talking about the uncertainty of the timing.
Yes.
So maybe that's the emphasis, that's really the main point of the comparison to Noah, was that they weren't aware that something was going to happen, and it happened. I mean, these people were marrying, eating, drinking, they were just going about their business. And maybe we're reading too much into it to give them to say that Jesus is saying everything about that time would be like this day.
You can.
I think the primary point is that the suddenness or the uncertainty, you know, the timing. There's
a huge amount of emphasis on that. There's no doubt about it, because Jesus talks about watch. In Mark 13, which we may have somebody look at in a bit, he talks about, you know, praying, and three different words there to describe the element of watchfulness. And I don't doubt that you're exactly right there. With the information in Revelation 17 and 18, I'm inclined to also include the other thought, but as far as I would say the predominant point, yes. You're not going to know when it's going to come, and people are not going to be expecting it, so you do need to be ready. So, yes, that's where we need to put the largest amount of emphasis. Stan?
The interesting thing about that timing is when, in the days of Noah, who were the people that were expecting anything?
Mm-hmm.
Those that were ungodly,
yeah,
that weren't expecting anything. It was only Noah and his family that would be expecting it to happen, other than the fact that Noah said it was going to happen. But they wouldn't have had any reason to.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the end of time, how many people are going to be even thinking about it's going to happen? Well, we don't know, because as you said, we don't know how many faithful that there are going to be. But for the most of the world, they're not going to be looking for anything.
Yeah, well, so at least some in Noah's day had to have heard. And maybe today that's going to be the same kind of thing that happens. People will have heard a Bible story, or maybe they'll have read that or heard a preacher or something. But as far as actually thinking about that, 1 Thessalonians 5 says that it's going to be like a thief in the night. Sudden destruction comes. And then, you know, it's kind of like a woman in labor pains. The Bible uses that analogy, like it's here. And, well, we maybe had some knowledge that it was coming, but we just didn't expect this. Anybody else before we make a couple of the points?
Those who are religious will be surprised, simply because they don't know when it's happening,
Right.
But the rest of the world, it's going to be a shock to them.
Well, that's what Jesus says here, the next point. Those in Noah's day eventually realized that God does exist. The flood came, and the text says, took them all away. So whatever knowledge they had, it became very real at some point. And such will also be true for people at the end of time. Regardless of what they knew, when the Lord shows up, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, whether we had a little knowledge of this or we were, reasonably convinced that it might come, there's not going to be any doubt about that. When he does return, every single person will be a believer. But you also have this point to consider. When the flood showed up, any hope of getting on the ark? I mean, you're shut out. And once again, a similarity, I think, here, well, a couple of points as far as similarity. When he shows up, any hope of salvation? You're either ready or you're not. You've prepared or you've not prepared. And then, too, you think about another Old Testament comparison. We've done some teaching on this as far as Sunday nights. Types in the Old Testament, how they sometimes point forward to things in the New Testament era. It may be that the flood was a type in various ways as far as Jesus' next and final coming. There does seem to be some comparison between the flood and, for example, the church. How many arks were there? One. You know, when you go back and you look at the doors and so forth, you see some other comparisons there which are instructive. All right, anything else that you want to add or ask before I say a couple more things here? Okay. Since his next and final return is going to be without signs, people, as Brian mentioned earlier, 42, they need to watch for it. Verse 44 says they need to be ready for it. Mark 13:33, that's the cross-reference that I was thinking of. Anybody want to head over there and take care of that for us in just a moment? Mark 13, verse 33. Jeff? And as this verse is read, you'll see three key words. Heed, take heed, watch, and pray. Each of these words is expressed with a present tense. So Jesus says, do these things and continue to do them throughout your life on earth because you don't know when this time is going to be. All right? Mark 13:33, Jeff?
Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come.
Okay. Translated a little differently, but again, those three basic points. Watch, pray, take heed, be prepared, because you don't know when this event's going to occur. The word that's translated flood in Matthew 24, verses 38 and 39, is the basis for English word cataclysm. Not everybody agrees on this, but if you have, in my mind, what was a sudden worldwide flood, what can that do? Just think about today. A quick downpour. I mean, it's just we had one of those the other day, a violent downpour where the rain just... is one of those gully washers. What can it do?
Oh, it's a flash flood.
Yeah. And, you know, cars can be swept away, and you sometimes find some mountains that there's some hills that don't do so well and so forth. It's interesting. Genesis 8, verse 22. What happens before we find a reference in the Bible to cold, heat, winter, and summer? What Bible event happens before we read about? The flood. Now, maybe those things were prior to the flood and God just didn't mention them. But when we look at what water does today, I'm inclined to think that the flood made some huge changes to the earth. When you begin, some people have suggested that it may have carved out a good section of the Grand Canyon. Other people think that it resulted in some huge changes to the climate. I think that's at least likely. And some people have proposed that dinosaurs, and you know maybe some other creatures, maybe not the dinosaurs, but some of the species may have disappeared because after a time they just couldn't adjust to life after the flood, so that may not have been immediate, but there do appear to be several changes that were linked to that. As Jesus talks about the flood, he refers to the ark, he refers to Noah. It's a point in passing to make note of, but it's important. Sometimes people just say, well, I don't believe in Adam and Eve. I don't believe in Noah. I don't believe there was a literal ark. Well, if Jesus was the Son of God, and he comes along and he starts talking about Noah and Moses and Adam and Eve and an ark, guess what? He believed in him, so we better believe in him as well. So as far as historical truthfulness or historical fiction, Jesus affirmed that these things are historically accurate. Anything that you want to add or ask before I kind of switch gears and show you something that I think is worth exploring as a class, but... it's going to take a little bit of a thinking process to wrap our heads around it. Anybody? Okay. In the classes that we've gone through as far as Matthew 24, I've said that there are three accounts of this. We have Matthew 24. Anybody else remember where it occurs? It's also in Mark 13. And it's also in the book of Luke chapter 21. Now, in Matthew 24, we have some information that sounds a lot like what we find in the book of Luke, Luke 17. And I'm going to flip over there for just a second, and I'd like you to do that as well. Here's some stuff that puzzled me for a long time, and it's puzzled some other people for a long time. But I think if you look at it, we can make sense of it. And remember, let's go back and think about where our three parallels are. Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. But we're not turning to Luke 21, we're turning to Luke 17. Now, we've not quite gotten this far yet, but in Matthew 24, he's going to talk about two men out there in the field. He's going to talk about two women that are grinding at the mill and so forth. And he says, one is taken, one is left. Well, Luke uses this same basic information and adds a little bit to it. He talks about two men in a bed and gives an illustration about Lot and so forth. And a lot of people look at this information, and because it's similar to Matthew 24, they assume the similarity means that the two things have to be identical. I don't think that's true for a couple of reasons. Even though the illustrations are essentially the same, when you look at Luke 16 and 17, you've got Luke 16 referring to the rich man and Lazarus. Then you've got the Samaritan, the leper and so forth, and you've got the widow and the judge. Luke 17 comes a lot earlier than Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Now, bearing that in mind, let's pick up down here with about 25. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected of this generation. And as it came to pass in the days of Noah, and here again, this is just what we went over in Matthew 24. And as it came to pass in the days of Noah, even so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. Now, I read that quickly, but anybody notice anything odd? Yeah. So if you were looking at this and you say, in the days of the Son of Man, well, that's kind of strange. Because in Matthew 24, as we've talked about the section 35 and 36 and following that deals with Jesus coming at the end of time, it's not days, that was destruction of Jerusalem, but now it is the day, the hour, that specific time. So if people are not careful when they read through Luke 17, I think a lot of times they'll miss that detail and just think, well, this is just another account. But days, plural. They ate, they drank, they married, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Well, we just went over that. Likewise, even as it came to pass in the days of Lot. Now, here's a new illustration. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built it. But in the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. After the same manner shall it be in the day, now there is a singular, that the Son of Man is revealed. In that day. And then, as I say, if you study this, you can begin to see how the information looks to be parallel, but it's not. He says, in that day. What day? Well, the day that he's talking about here in Luke 17, right? He says, in that day, do what? If you're on the housetop,
don't go in.
Don't go in. How well is that going to work when Jesus comes back at the end of time? Yeah, your house is going to be burned up, right? So as he talks about this, when he begins a discussion back there in 25 and 26, he gives us the word generation, which, okay, that doesn't answer every question, but at least that kind of puts us in a general time period. Then he talks about the days of the Son of Man. Well, that doesn't square up very well with the destruction, with his next and final coming. And then he talks about, you know, these things that were taking place, which that sounds a lot like Matthew 24. But then as he continues the point, as we just pointed out, he says, in that day, going back and referring to that time, he says something that was related to the destruction of Jerusalem, then gives the example of Lot's wife. And then in 33, whosoever shall seek to gain his life shall lose it. Whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. And then he talks about in 34 and 35. Some people will say, well, okay, maybe that's the destruction of Jerusalem. But down here in 34 and 35, look. In that night there shall be two men on one bed. The one shall be taken, the other shall be left. There shall be two women grinding together. The one shall be taken, the other will be left. So people will say, well, this has got to refer to the end of time. Well, let's read one more verse, 37. And they answering saying to him, where, Lord? And he said unto them, where the body is, thither will the eagles be gathered together. Do you think we'll find any eagles or vultures hanging around when the Lord returns? No. So it's one more clue that in Luke 17, this is a passage, as I said, which was given much earlier than the information in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And even though Jesus used some of the same illustrations and some of the same language, He also gives several clues in Luke 17 that this is not about my next and final coming. So if you've ever looked at this and you thought, well, hey, this is kind of unusual, and how does this fit in? It fits in from the standpoint that Jesus was, just like today, people will sometimes use the same illustrations, but they use them in different ways. So it pays, especially when we're dealing with this kind of information, pays to pay very close attention to the text. Anything that you want to add or ask or offer a different view on? Okay, let's go back to Matthew 24. And now let's look at some of the same information that we just read about in Luke 17. But only here in Matthew 24, starting with verse 40, we're dealing with the second coming. He says, "Then shall two men be in the field, one is taken and one is left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, one is taken and one is left. Watch therefore, for ye know not on what day your Lord cometh." Now, if you have talked with people from the denominational world, what have you heard them say about these verses? Oh, here is the
rapture,
right? Well, the word rapture is a Latin term. It means to snatch up, to snatch away, to take away. And there are a lot of people who believe that a time is going to come. The Bible doesn't teach this, but they think that a time is going to come when the Lord is going to rapture the saved. He's going to take them up into heaven. They're going to spend a period of time there. And then the unsaved are going to experience some very bad things here on the earth. Well, the word rapture, as I said, is not found in the Bible, but sometimes people try to make it appear that way. One of the difficulties with this idea, at least from this context, is found in verse 37. What did Jesus say about his end of time coming? He says his coming is going to be like the time of Noah. All right, now let's think about the rapture idea. What's going to happen? Jesus is going to come back. Where do the righteous people go? Up in heaven with him. Is that what happened with the flood?
No.
Where are the righteous folks? They're here on the earth. Well, that doesn't sound like a very good comparison. And then as you look at the other half of the rapture, and that idea says that the unrighteous, what's going to happen to them? They're going to stay on the earth, and they're going to experience some really bad things. Well, if we go back to the time of Noah, is that what happened for the unrighteous people? No. They didn't continue to live on the earth. They got wiped out. So if this verse is supposed to illustrate the rapture or teach the rapture, Jesus used a very bad comparison. Now I'm going to talk about the two women and two men, but let's see if there's anything that you want to discuss before we move to that part of the verse. Dolores?
Somebody say, well, you know, when Noah was taken into the ark with his family, that is compared to the righteous going to heaven. And the same with the evil being suffering and destroyed, they were suffering before they were drowned.
Yes, that's going... Right, that's going to be the best that you can do with that. And there are, as I said, there are some comparisons. We have this Old Testament event or person points forward to the new. But I'd say, well, do you really want to camp out on that belief? Is that really the comparison that you're making? And then probably going to do some other passages. But, and as I said, you know, if you're going to try to explain that point from this passage, you have limited information to work with, but the comparison is really not all that workable for the rapture folks. But you gave the best answer that they can give on it. Okay, I thought there was another hand that flashed. Okay, a lot of Christians, and this is, you know, as I think about the questions that I've been asked over the years, these two verses are probably among the most commonly asked about verses, at least people that have talked to me and several other preachers. Jesus talked about two men, he spoke about two women, and he said that how many of these people were going to be taken? One of each, or half. If you've got four folks and one of each is taken, then two are taken, two are going to be left. Well, I don't think that what he says here is all that difficult. It's simply another way to describe what's going to occur when he does return at the end of time. There are going to be some who are going to be taken, in that sense, taken where? To heaven. And there are going to be some other folks who are left, in what sense? All right, left for destruction, punishment, left for hell. And they were the people, and he's going to say a little bit more about this, but as Brian mentioned, you have a lot of emphasis in the context about being prepared. 42, watch therefore, for you know not on the day that your Lord's going to return. And then 44, therefore, be also ready. The three present tense verbs that we talked about in Mark 13. And then look at what follows, 45 to 51. Who then is the faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath set over his household to give them their food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he's coming, shall find him so doing. Verily I say unto you that he will set him over all that he hath. But if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord tarrieth, and shall begin to beat his fellow servants, and shall eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he expecteth not, and in an hour when he knoweth not, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. In 45 through 51, Jesus here makes that same point. There are some faithful servants. There are some unfaithful servants. The faithful servants are going to be taken. The unfaithful servants are going to be left. So if people were to just read the next few verses, but Jesus doesn't stop there. As you think about the next chapter, somebody want to read Matthew 25, 1 and 2? Harvey?
Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto the 10 virgins who took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish.
Just the second verse. Thank you very much. Okay, so you have here the same idea. You have how many that were wise? 5. How many that were foolish? Do you see how the point just continues to develop? One taken, one left. Some servants are faithful, some servants are not. And then we get into the story about the 10 virgins. You have 5 faithful, 5 not. He's saying, look, guys, you can be on this side of the fence or you can be on the other. And if they didn't get it by this point, remember a little further down in Matthew 25, Jesus says, I'm going to come back. And when I come back, there are going to be people who are put into two groups. Some are going to be like the sheep on my right hand. Others are going to be like the goats, and they're going to be on my left. So it is the same point. He repeats it time and time again. Most people, I think, don't have much difficulty with all the illustrations that he deals with, but they fail to start at the beginning of the illustrations, back here in verses 40 through 42. And if they would simply move back a little bit and read a little bit more of the context, it would make all the sense in the world. Anything that you want to add or ask before I make one other quick point? All right, 28 and 29. Marvel not at this, for the hour cometh in which all they that are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, the taken. They that have done evil unto the resurrection of judgment. So throughout the Bible you have information about these two classes, and it's just one more way to illustrate what we have here. Yes, it absolutely is. 24 and 25. And even with Noah, you've got the folks in the ark, you've got the people outside the ark. So very good cross-reference. Harvey? Okay. Let me make this point too. Remember I said Luke 17 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem as I understand that passage. Let's go back there and pick up that point that I mentioned a little earlier. Luke 17, 34, because I think there's a principle here that not only applied to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, but it's also going to be relevant to Jesus' next and final coming. He said, I say unto you, in that night there shall be two men on one bed, and one shall be taken and the other left. Now, when you think about that, you know, typically in our day and time, when you have two people on or in the same bed, why is that? Why is somebody crawling in the sack with you?
Married.
Well, okay. That's...
Well, two men, okay.
No, you've got the right answer. I just am looking to express it in a different way. But what is marriage? What kind of relationship is that? All right, it's supposed to be a close relationship. There's that one flesh relationship, if you will. So usually if you're crawling in the sack with somebody, there's some kind of special bond, right? There's some kind of close relationship, other exceptions, but generally that's true. All right, Jesus, as he talks about this back in Luke 17, he says there's going to be a split. You know, one taken, one left. Well, in principle, as we think about this and we look at it from the standpoint of Jesus' next and final coming, what's going to happen to people, to some people who are in those close relationships? You think there are some husbands that are going to be saved and the wives are not? You think there are going to be some brothers who are separated from their sisters? Sons separated from mom, separated from dad, cousin, aunts, uncles, and so forth? You know, you think Noah had any family outside the ark? I'm pretty sure he did. And exactly who those folks were, we'll probably never know in this life. But the Bible says, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 19, the Lord knows those who are his. And because he knows the sheep, John 10, he's not going to let anybody come into the fold that shouldn't be there. Don?
There is significance to the fact that when he's talking about this, one will be taken, one will be left. All these that you quoted, that equal 50-50 split.
As far as the saved and lost?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these examples you've given is the 50-50 split. One will be taken, one will be left.
Okay. If we didn't have any other information, I think that might be a conclusion that we'd look at. But I'm going to go back to Matthew 7. Pat, did you want to...
And again, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, there's a completely, the idea of 50-50 is able to show, if we did it in thirds or quarters or actual numbers, it doesn't show the point that it's being illustrated, which is a distinct aspect of there are those faithful. In fact, in God's eyes, in St. Charles' scripture, there's only 2 nations in this world. We don't want to make all the different nations. There are
right.
Only 2. There's only those that are God's and those that are not.
Right. With that, and with Don's question, Matthew 7, 13, and 14 kind of springs to mind. Jesus says, enter ye in by what kind of gate?
Narrow.
The narrow gate. And then he gives a reason. He says, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And how many? 50%? Many. Now, I know you knew that passage. And then he talks about the other few. But when we kind of get our minds over here in Matthew 24 and we're thinking about, well, hey, it sounds like a 50-50 split. There's, and I probably need to include that passage in the notes to help us realize that he's talking about a division. When we think about a 50-50 split, we're certainly thinking about a division. But here, it is not an equal division because of what we find in Matthew 7. So, good question and a helpful point. Virginia?
I have 2 men in a bed. I probably got 10 because of the way the 1800s were like. Here, it wasn't uncommon for 2 men. I mean, if you went into a room,
right. Did they actually rent part of the bed?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, but if you rent a room, you didn't get the whole room. You didn't get the whole bed. You had to share it. Maybe sometimes they said 3 in the bed.
I knew about bed sharing, but I never realized when you went to the check-in desk, which do you want the right side or the left side or the top or the bottom? But that... We learned some interesting things in Bible class, don't we? So thank you. That's fascinating stuff. But here Jesus, as he talks about this, you not only have that illustration which was for the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, but here he talks about 2 men working in the field. Well, you know, you're not always friends with the person that you're working with, but a lot of times today you're out there on the line with somebody, or you've got 2 drivers, they're making, you know, cross-country runs. Generally, they're going to be pretty good friends. And you see about 2 policemen that ride together. I mean, they might be closer in that relationship than the husband and wife. And then you have the other relationship here as far as 2 women. You know, they're going out there and they're at the mill together. They're involved in daily food preparation, which we'll say a little bit more about. You've got 2 women that are working together every day to prepare food for the house. You think they're going to be close?
At least well acquainted.
Yeah, they should be at least well acquainted. You know, they're talking and they've got good friendships and maybe a very intimate bond. But Jesus, by making this statement, he says, one's going to be taken, one's going to be left. This is not a good way to say it, but I'm going to phrase it in this way. God does not care about those bonds when it comes to salvation and condemnation. They will make no difference whatsoever. That's right. That's the only bond that's going to matter. You know, come ye blessed of my Father, and hear the kingdom prepared for me from the foundation of the world. Why? Because here was my will, and you did it. Hebrews 5, 8, and 9, he's the author of salvation to those who obey him. So that is the bond that matters, and those family ties are just not going to get it. We could be related to a preacher, an elder, or a deacon, or whomever, but the tie that counts is the tie to Christ. Any other thought there that somebody wants to add? Okay, we'll see a little bit more about these verses next week, and then pick up with verses 43 and 44. Thank you.